Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar series. I'm Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. It's nice to be an online program. The snowstorm in Washington on Monday hasn't interfered with our plans, and those of you who live around here know that a snowstorm on Monday can still be in your back pocket on Thursday. So we're here, no repercussions, and you are here, so thank you. As I've said many times since October 7th, the JPC doesn't do battlefield updates. We try to focus on broader issues, but sometimes a specific activity has wider implications. Today, one of those activities makes us think regionally. So aside from this being my 13th anniversary with the JPC, and sometime this month marking our fifth year of web programming, today is, or was, Election Day in Lebanon. And if you think the American election was jarring, we are going to consider how the Lebanese people got to this point in what was once a really nice country that has been under, I don't know what, occupation? I don't know. Something happened to it at some point, and maybe an election is the way to get it back on track. David Dowd, our guest, is going to take us there, and he is just the guy to do it. He's going to talk about Lebanon. He's going to talk about the interconnected wars with Syria, with Hamas, and how it impacts the region, and whether Lebanon has hopes for the future. But before I introduce David, I'm going to do a short introduction of the JPC. So people ask me, why do I do this every week? And I'm happy to brag. First of all, we've been off for 2 weeks, and I don't want you to forget anything. But secondly, our audience is big and it's growing, and I'm happy to have the new people. So here we go. The Jewish Policy Center was founded in 1985 to provide perspectives and analysis of foreign and domestic policies by scholars, academics, and commentators. Our website is jewishpolicycenter.org, and you can sign in there for our insight articles, our in-tech context blog, and you can see our magazine In Focus quarterly. The winter issue of In Focus just went up. It's called Iran, Freedom or Fire. I cannot decide whether it's an optimistic thought or a pessimistic thought, but I guarantee you our authors will give you something to think about and worry about. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Right now, our most important job is to support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And now more than ever, we support the government of Israel and the IDF in the defense of the people of Israel and bringing the perpetrators of the massacres, rapes, hostage taking, and rocket barrages to justice, forcing Hamas to release the hostages, and finishing the job of eliminating the military and governing capabilities of both Hamas and Hezbollah. As a side gig, we're going to try to get rid of UNRWA and UNIFIL as well. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. That's us, jewishpolicycenter.org. Our speaker today is David Dowd, a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, FDD, focusing on Hezbollah and Lebanon. He previously worked as a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council, director of Israel and Lebanon, and, oh, excuse me, Israel and Lebanon and Syria research at United Against a Nuclear Iran, and a research analyst at FDD. David also has experience working as a staff member on Capitol Hill, providing people up there who need it with analysis on matters related to the Middle East and specifically Israel and Iran. He holds a JD with a concentration in international law and the laws of armed conflict. Very important stuff right now, where people have forgotten that there are such things as laws of armed conflict. He is fluent in Arabic and Hebrew, and he spent extensive time living in the Middle East, primarily in Israel, and today's primary, though not only, subject of interest, Lebanon. His work has been cited or published in outlets from Haaretz to Foreign Policy to Newsweek, the New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal. All important places to be. David Dowd, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana. Thank you for that very kind introduction, and thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be on. It is I would say an important day in some ways, but also a day that's just like any other, and we'll get into why that is. I guess I want to address, let me start by addressing what Shoshana raised about Lebanon. And I think from there we can build up to where we are today and what that means for the future. So the idea that, there's this idea that Lebanon was the Paris of the Middle East, that prior to 1975, Lebanon had this so-called golden age. And I think that I would wholeheartedly disagree with that, right? I think part of that misunderstanding leads us, or part of that myth leads us to a lot of misunderstandings about where Lebanon is today, where it's going to go moving forward. So Lebanon was a creation of the Maronites and the French, essentially similar to how the Israelis or the Jews at the time had the mandate for Palestine with the British. The Maronites were trying to have something similar with Lebanon. The problem is that the areas of Maronite concentration in Lebanon, Mount Lebanon, are not territorially viable, right? They're too landlocked, they're small. So Lebanon, the idea of Lebanon became expanded into this idea of Grand Liban, Great Lebanon, the bigger Lebanon, Eretz Lebanon Shlema, if you will. And that included the 10,000 plus square kilometers that comprise Lebanon, or of which Lebanon is comprised today, the map that we know of Lebanon. The problem with that is, again, as Jews, as Zionists, as Israelis, we can understand demographics, right? Demographics, demographics, demographics. In Israel, the debate over a two-state solution versus a one-state solution. Right, the old Jabotinskian idea of a one-state solution that would be Jewish and democratic at the same time, but that would stretch from the river to the sea, is complicated by the fact that there just aren't enough Jews in that territory. And if you were to incorporate the West Bank, Judea, Samaria, and give everyone citizenship there, you'd have demographic parity, and that simply doesn't work, right? It doesn't work anywhere in history. Where you've seen groups of people that have near demographic parity and that have contradictory ideas about how a state is supposed to run, about how society is supposed to run. I mean, if we look at, again, Lebanon is a prime example, Iraq, Syria, Belgium, even, lest we think that this is just the confines of or confined to the Middle East. So when we come to Lebanon, the territory of Lebanon had to be expanded to include Druze, with whom the Maronites had had their own civil war in the 1800s. And as we know in the Middle East, enmities die very hard. Sunnis, on the coastal region mostly in Lebanon, and the Sunnis are, they weren't wedded to this idea of Lebanon as an independent state. Let's not forget that Lebanon was taken away from what was once a relatively unified territory known as Bilad al-Sham, right? This greater Syria. So the Sunnis, being Pan-Arabist, more linked to their Islamic identity and more linked to their Arab identity, did not see any utility in this idea of an independent Lebanon. And then you had the Shiites, who are now kind of, not political, or they weren't political at the time, but they still added to the Muslim demographic majority that eventually tilted against the Christians and made this idea of the Maronite Lebanon, this creation of the Maronite mindset, much more complicated or much more untenable. Imagine if you had, a situation where Jews in Israel comprised 30% of the country, right? You couldn't really sustain a Jewish state. So then, in this situation, you have this idea that's a conception of the Maronites, but then it hits up against demographic realities. So the Lebanese initially created this power sharing agreement, the National Accords, whereby the president would be a Maronite, the prime minister would be a Sunni, and the speaker of parliament a Shiite, and you wouldn't have a census, right? We would just assume, pretend that Lebanon still has a 51% Christian majority, and there hasn't been a census since 1932 in Lebanon. And even the reliability of that census has been called into question. But look, reality tends to, you can try to hide reality as much as you want, but then you start hitting up against reality. And in the early days of Lebanon, from independence, 1946, really, when the French left Lebanon up until 1975, this is the golden age period of Lebanon, the pre-Civil War period of Lebanon. You actually had a mini civil war in 1958 over the same reasons that would lead to the outbreak of the 1975 Civil War, well, in some with some tweaks. So the issue is that everyone started to look around and say, well, hold on, there are more Muslims in this country than there are Christians. How come you're getting two-thirds of parliament, the most powerful seat in government, which was at the time the presidency, and we have to sit for the table scraps when we're the majority? Also, you're taking the country in a certain direction, right? More Western-oriented, more French-oriented, into alliances with the United States. We're not so inclined. We have Arabist orientations. We have Islamic loyalties and linkages. We view ourselves as Arabs and as part of the Arab world. And this kind of erupted into a mini civil war in 1958 with Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was the president of Egypt at the time, backing these Arabist factions in Lebanon against the president, the Lebanese president, and his cohort. And President Eisenhower, our President Eisenhower, had to send the Marines in to save Lebanon essentially from itself. And this is the theme you will see even when it comes to Hezbollah, and we'll get to that. But really, it is saving Lebanon from itself, which is a question of whether we should do that or not. So then, Lebanon, because of these dynamics, because of the tensions between the two poles in Lebanon in 1969, cedes effective authority over the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, allows the Palestinians to start bearing arms. And the Palestinians, of course, abuse that because why wouldn't a faction that is allowed to carry arms outside of the ambit of the state abuse its power? And the clash, the friction between the PLO and the other Palestinian factions in Lebanon and the guardians of Maronite Lebanon, the Kataib, the Phalangists, and other allied forces, that friction led to the civil war. And as Lebanon, or as this friction, which was really a Palestinian Maronite war, broke out, the old enmities, the old grievances, I often tell my Maronite friends in Lebanon, well, if Lebanon was such a paradise prior to 1975, why did your Sunni compatriot, your co-citizen, line up with the foreign Palestinian against his Christian neighbor? Clearly, there were grievances that led to that fracturing. Now, the Shiites largely remained out of this. But so this is to the point of like Lebanon's golden age. It really didn't exist. It was a veneer that was maintained by the French, or that was created by the French mandate, and that lasted for several years, but then fell apart. This was always beneath the surface. Now, this fractiousness in Lebanon, the idea, the fact that there is no cohesive national identity, the fact that there isn't really a cohesive sectarian identity, because if you look at each of the individual sects, they break down into feudal leadership. So if you look at the Maronites, there's not a united Maronite leadership. You have those who follow on, the former president, not the current president as of today. You have those who follow Samir Jaja of the Lebanese forces. You have those who follow the Kata'ib, those who follow the Mawads. Right? So it's not just the Maronites or the Christians united as one faction, or with one, or even that these factions have the same mindset or the same loyalties. Right? Slimane Frangieh, who was a candidate for president, is a Maronite Christian. He couldn't be more pro-Hezbollah. He couldn't be more pro-Assad when there was an Assad regime. You have the Aounists, right, who follow Michel Aoun, the Free Patriotic Movement. They pragmatically lined up with Hezbollah. They pragmatically had good relations with Syria. They pragmatically developed a modus vivendi with the broader Iranian-led resistance axis. And again, they're Maronite Christians. And yet you have Sunnis like Saad Hariri, who at least on paper oppose all of these things. So this old idea that, we as Jews developed in the 1980s, there was a myth that we were sold through the Israelis. They were also sold this myth of this inherently natural Maronite Jewish alliance, that if these two, that these were natural allies, these were natural brothers, that they were both non-Arab, non-Muslim, in this region, and therefore they had a natural inclination towards one another. It was never, this was an image that was sold to the Israelis by the Ismailis, by Bashir Ismail specifically, to use Israeli military might to accomplish domestic goals. And the Israelis really got taken for a loop. And this is how we get to where Hezbollah comes into the picture, because you have this fractious identity of the Shiites on the side. They're kind of the neglected child of Lebanon, even though they're, as far as we can tell today, Lebanon's largest demographic. Again, we can't tell with precision, but there are ways you can kind of piece the puzzle together. So, You have this disenfranchised community. You don't have a sense of Lebanese belonging. And then you have this Israeli invasion that comes in on Maronite terms, right? I always say that every step that Israel took past the 40-kilometer line in the Litani River in 1982 was not Israel fighting for its security interests. It was fighting for this fantasy that they were sold by the Gemayels. And they sold them also a fantasy of Lebanon's demographic makeup. Now, Israel doesn't have Shiites. It had no idea what Shiites were. It had no idea what their sentiments were. So it comes in with these Maronite blinders on what is Lebanon and ends up with friction, right? Because South Lebanon is predominantly Shiite. So it starts rubbing up against the Shiites and their sensibilities. And as will happen with any military occupation, you're going to have blood. And that blood, there's an incident in Nabatieh in 1983. This is a major city in South Lebanon. So the Shiites have this annual Ashura pilgrimage, or this, sorry, annual Ashura commemoration. This is the commemoration of the martyrdom of their saint, their primary saint, Hussein. There's an Israeli military patrol going through, they see this procession. You know, they're beating themselves. They're self-flagellating. The Israelis don't know what's going on. They get out. They fire into the air. The mourners respond, and this results in a clash where people are killed. These were the seeds that planted the room for Iran with nascent Hezbollah. Now, Hezbollah wasn't created by the Israeli invasion. It was always kind of waiting in the wings. And the Israeli invasion and the friction it created allowed this movement to catalyze and come into the fore. And they came and said, "Well, no, look, they're enemies of the Shiites. We'll protect you. And the state can't protect you because there is no state. There is no Lebanese identity." So this is kind of where Lebanon, this is the genesis of where Lebanon is today. And this, you know, has led us to where we are today, in that Hezbollah is not an alien entity entirely. Yes, it's entirely loyal to Iran. It's entirely it abides by this idea of Wilayat al-Faqih. It views Ayatollah Ali Khamenei as essentially the Shiite Pope, the voice of God on earth. But at the same time, it is 100% comprised of Lebanese. It is 100% comprised of Lebanese citizens. It is based in Lebanon. Its supporters are Lebanese citizens. So to call it an occupation, I think, is, you know, so you have kind of two very simplified versions of Lebanon. One is that Lebanon equals Hezbollah equals Lebanon. That's one simplistic version. But the other simplistic version is that Hezbollah is merely occupying Lebanon. It's not the case. Again, this fractious Lebanese identity allowed for a particularist Shiite movement to arise and say, "We will take care of Shiite interests, both domestically against the Maronites and the Sunnis and the Druze that have neglected you and that have not given you your due, and against foreign entities like the Israelis, who in the conception that Hezbollah has sold the Shiites, just wake up every morning and want to do them harm for no other reason than Israel's very nature. And the one thing that's standing between them," alleges Hezbollah, is the strength of the resistance. So Hezbollah is not this outlier in Lebanon. And let's talk statistics. I mean, I think Shoshana follows me on Twitter and probably sees me tweet these things out incessantly, because nothing gets under my skin more than the kind of this narrative that's promoted by certain Lebanese activists who may be pro-Israel in their inclinations, maybe, and I stress the maybe, pro-American or pro-Western in their inclinations, but really are replicating this deception, and whether knowingly or not, that Bashir Gemayel employed against the Israelis in 1982, telling them, "Hey, do everything for me, and I'll make peace with Israel, and I'll make peace with the United States. I will fix Lebanon. But hey, you pay the price in blood and treasure." And I think we both agree here: American blood, Israeli blood, American taxpayer dollars, Israeli taxpayer dollars are too precious to be wasted on adventures to suit the fantasies of certain Lebanese activists. So there are people who tell you there's a Shiite opposition to Hezbollah. Well, let's look at the numbers. So in the May 2022 elections, parliamentary elections, Hezbollah won 356,000 and some change votes. Right? That is the highest number of votes that any party in Lebanon obtained, by 150,000. The second largest party by number of votes was the Lebanese Forces Party. Now, because of the seat distribution mechanism for parliament, Lebanese Forces got 19 seats, whereas Hezbollah got 15 seats. But Hezbollah, in absolute numbers, received 356,000 votes, 150,000 more votes than the Lebanese Forces. Now, this was out of a total voter turnout of 1.8 million, in a country of about 4.5 million people. And that's just people who went up to vote. That is not 350, let's just say 356,000 are Hezbollah's absolute number of supporters. That's not a negligible number in a country of 4.5 million. But that's not only there, right? That's not the totality of their supporters. We get to statistics. So in January of 2024, Washington Institute conducted a poll that showed that 89% of Lebanese Shiites strongly support Hezbollah. 93% support them to some degree. In September of 2024, now, of course, there's margins of error for minimal margins of error for such polls. September of 2024, Arab Barometer, another credible polling entity, showed that 85% of Lebanese Shiites support Hezbollah to some degree, and only 5% don't at all. So you have that 5%, right? If we look at either the Winnet poll, the Washington Institute poll, or the Arab Barometer poll, you have an opposition that is at maximum 5 to 7%, right? This is up against the overwhelming majority of Lebanese Shiites, who again are Lebanon's possibly largest and definitely largest growing demographic, right? They have bigger families, bigger children. They're of a lower, generally their socioeconomic status is lower, so they have less emigration or lower emigration rates than other wealthier, more educated, more affluent, more Western linked factions in Lebanon, say the Maronites. I mean, the majority of the Maronites are outside of Lebanon now. So you have this body in Lebanon, and they look to Hezbollah as their primary representative. Now they're divided in some ways between Amal, the kind of the classical, more Lebanese nationalist Shiite party, which is sometimes Hezbollah's foe, but more often than not, they cooperate with each other because they have the shared Shiite interest. And you have the hardcore of supporters in each party. They probably hate each other, right? But you have this overlap, right? It's Shiite identity will lead most, even soft supporters from Amal or soft supporters from Hezbollah, to view the bodies, these two bodies, as interchangeable. So if you're a Lebanese politician, right, and the way Lebanon is divided up because, again, lack of national identity, fractious national identity, is the best way I liken it to is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, right, if we're all familiar with that, and that you have this one body that everyone's laying claim to, right? And they're all Christian in a broader sense, but they all have very different definitions of Christianity, and they're all in kind of friction and competition with each other. And so there's divisions of piece of the pie, right? I don't know if anyone's been to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre when even when you walk in. My first time was going last summer. So when you walk in, there's all these lanterns, right? And each church has a lantern, or like I think it's an incense holder. But it's all laying stake. And if you've ever walked by the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you'll notice there's a ladder. And no one knows why that ladder is there. But God forbid you should move it because you might have the ladder intifada on your hands. So, and this is how Lebanon is. Each portion of Lebanon, the Shiites, the Sunnis, the Druze, the Maronites, they all have a piece of the Lebanese pie. And if any other sect moves, if the Sunnis try to move the Maronite sect's piece of the pie, if they try to move their figurative ladder, there's going to be trouble. Now, how do you apportion this power? You don't just give it to Sunnis generally. You don't just give it to Maronites generally. You give it to these subsectarian representative parties. So, in the case of the Shiites, Amal and Hezbollah, because they are the largest parties, they are the largest representatives of these two factions. So, if you're sitting there and apportioning government positions, cabinet ministries, you can't say Lebanese forces, we like you. You get seats in the cabinet, or you get a say in who's elected president, or you get this influence over the army, or what have you. And then Hezbollah, you get nothing. Because by telling Hezbollah you get nothing, you're telling the Shiites you get nothing. Right? So, Hezbollah always has to be a part of the conversation. Otherwise, goes to civil war, like we saw in the past, right? When Sunni grievances and Muslim grievances in Lebanon led them to align with the PLO against their countrymen because they felt they weren't getting their fair share of the pie. So you want to disarm Hezbollah, which we'll get into how it's not the president's job to do that in Lebanon. You have to get Hezbollah's permission, right? Because you have to do everything by consensus. If you remember, there was a trash crisis in Lebanon a few years back. Lebanon couldn't pick up its trash. There was a massive river of trash in Beirut that was just left there. Why? Because there couldn't be consensus on how they would pick up the trash, where they would put it, what company would be tasked with doing so. So if picking up trash, something as simple as picking up trash, takes all this squabbling, if getting a president takes all this squabbling, right? Because you have to get consensus. Imagine the question of Hezbollah's arms, something that is that existential for Hezbollah, something that, and look, it's not that I agree with this, but if we're putting ourselves in the shoes of the average Shiite in Lebanon, to them, Hezbollah's arms are the guarantor of their safety against evil, murderous Israel, as they view it, against these evil jihadist forces like ISIS that Hezbollah has told them are waiting right around the corner if Hezbollah were weakened to come do to them what they did, as we saw the atrocities across the region. And that's on the foreign side. On the domestic side, they are their guarantor of their personal dignity and for them having any political weight in Lebanon. So by taking away Hezbollah's arms, what you're saying indirectly to the Shiite is, we're going to disenfranchise you. This is how Hezbollah has positioned itself among the Shiites. So you can't just disarm them without their permission. You have to ask their permission. And look, Hezbollah may be a lot of things. They're not in the business of self-destruction. Only when they go on in adventures against Israel, and thankfully there they got a drubbing. But internally, they're not going to sign off on something where that says willingly you have to dissolve, because their arms are the source of their legitimacy. It's not the only thing. Right? And I say legitimacy. They're not necessarily holding Lebanon in terror. Right? They've convinced a broad swath of the Lebanese Shiites that their interests lie with them. And for those that aren't convinced, yes, they have the stick, but they also have lots of carrots. Right? They have schools. They have clinics. They have clothing stores. They have basically a shadow society within the society that provides to these Shiites anything that they could want. And usually at a higher quality than what the Lebanese state would provide. If you take Hezbollah schools, for example, the Mahdi, the Batul, the Mustafa schools, these multiple school systems that they have, they provide a top-notch education. So in Lebanon, the public school systems are atrocious, right? If you want your ch children to succeed, you're not sending them to public schools. If you're coming from majority of Lebanese Shiites, right? So you want to send them to a private school. So you have different streams of private schools. You have these foreign schools, these lycées, these French education schools. You have a lot of Maronite Catholic schools, but they're all private schools and they all cost money. So if you're coming from a lower socioeconomic status, you may not be able to afford it, especially if you have many children. So that complicates things. Comes Hezbollah and tells you, oh, you want your kid to have a good education? We'll take care of him. Send him to our school. We'll subsidize. And they teach you, again, top-notch education coupled with a slow drip of ideology. So if I'm a secular Shiite and I send my kid to the school because I want them to have a better education, they're going to come out maybe 5 to 10% more ideologically committed than I am. And that's a success for Hezbollah, because then maybe I, as my son as the graduate, will go and invest in Hezbollah's system, and send his son to their system. And over many generations, you end up with this ideologically cohesive base. But the point is, you can't ignore them. So how does this relate to Lebanon's election today? So elections in Lebanon, presidential elections, are not conducted the way we have them in the United States by popular vote. Well, in some degree, by popular vote, we have them in the United States. Parliament elects the president, right? The people elect their parliamentarians. The parliamentarians elect the president. Today, Hezbollah voted for Joseph Aoun, right? They voted for the man who now became president, who everyone is telling us, once this man is power, once this process moves, that Lebanon will disarm Hezbollah. And they voted for him after a meeting, a sideline meeting, in which they discussed matters of security, society, and reconstruction. Now, security, that's a code word for Hezbollah's arms. They received assurances from Saudi Arabia that voting for Aoun would not have any negative repercussions for them. Iran greenlit them voting for Michel, for sorry for Joseph Aoun. So they're going into this knowing that Aoun is not going to touch them, and he can't in any case, right? So one of the outgrowths of the civil war, it was what we call the Taif Accords or the Taif Agreements, depending who you're reading, but the Taif Agreement reshuffled the balance of power in Lebanon based on demographic realities. And because the Maronites didn't have the demographic weight that they used to, the Maronite office of government, the presidency, was stripped of a lot of its powers, and which was redistributed largely to the cabinet, which is Sunni dominated. Now, the Lebanese armed forces, the body that would be tasked with disarming Hezbollah, does not submit to the orders exclusively of the president. The order has to come from the cabinet. Now, this complicates matters, right? Because based on Lebanon's current parliamentary composition, you create a cabinet, just like in Israel, right? You create a coalition, except a little bit different in Lebanon. It's not exactly the same process. And in Lebanon, the tradition has been for a long time to have national unity governments, right? Every government that has been around for God knows how long has been some variation of a national unity government. Given that Hezbollah has 15 seats in parliament, and given that their ML party allies also have, I think, about 13 or 14 seats in parliament, they're going to work together to make sure that they have representatives in the cabinet. And they're going to put them in critical positions to prevent the cabinet, even were it willing, and we don't know that it's willing, but let's assume that they're willing, from taking action against Hezbollah. So this all this hailing of the president, it's one, even let's say Joseph Aoun in his heart of hearts, which I'm not his confessor, so I don't know what's in his heart of hearts, right? But let's assume in his heart of hearts, he's sitting there and saying, I want Lebanon to be a normal country, and the thing stopping me, the primary thing stopping me from transforming Lebanon from what it is today into a normal country, the first step is to disarm Hezbollah. It's not in his hands to do so. He doesn't have the power to do so. And in his speech today, yes, he did talk about a national defense strategy. He did talk about his acceptance speech. He did talk about monopolizing the use of force in the hands of the state. But he also talked about not overstepping his constitutional authorities and the separation of powers that are required by the Ta'ev Agreement. So he's not going to take that action based on his own words. So all we have now are lofty words, a lot of hopes, but the reality, the mechanism of how Lebanon works will probably ensure that Hezbollah is not disarmed. And look, again, even if there were this inclination, don't listen to me. Don't listen to David Daoud, the Zionist propagandist here, right? Let's listen to the Lebanese foreign minister, caretaker foreign minister, Abdullah Abu Habib, in January of 2024. He was in an interview with LBCI. This is a local Lebanese television station. And he says, the interviewer is asking about Hezbollah's arms. And obviously, there's a war going on at the time, the implications of what that war could bring upon Lebanon. And he tells the interviewer, he's like, look, if we leave Hezbollah armed, that means regional war, right? Because of Hezbollah's defensurism. If we try to disarm Hezbollah without Hezbollah's consent, you're talking civil war, right? And in every case, we will pick regional war over civil war because you can't predict the end of the civil war. So that's the balance of pain for Lebanon. You can leave Hezbollah, you can ignore them, and maybe once every 20 years you'll have a war with Israel. But if you have civil war, right, for the duration of that 20 years, you will have war, right? So the pain, there will always be more pain, right? If you go to disarm Hezbollah, you're going to get that civil war. So the balance of pain will always weigh in favor of Lebanon leaving Hezbollah to its devices. And that's most likely what we're going to see. And I'm therefore not optimistic. I think I've talked too much, but I'll turn it over to questions.
Okay, you don't talk too much. You've given us a master class in what we need to know because you poked holes in a lot of myths that Americans have, and that's really important. You answered the biggest question. We saw reports about the speech that Aoun made, in which he said only the state will have weapons. But if the state includes Hezbollah, then that makes everything else you said really important. We're applauding that. We Americans, our government is applauding that because he said, look, only the state, and Hezbollah is not the state. Yeah, it is. So that was the sort of most important thing, but it goes to this other question. And that is that the Biden administration is about to take money or wants to take money. I'm not sure what the congressional requirement here is going to be to take $100 million in military support from Israel and Egypt and put it into Lebanon, because he says, and many other people say too, the Lebanese armed forces are the alternative to Hezbollah. Maybe that was true at one point. Maybe that was a long time ago, the point. In fact, I know a number of American military officers, fine military officers, who worked with the Lebanese armed forces. Talk to us now about what would happen if the LAF got $100 million. They wouldn't get it all at once anyway, but what happens? Is that the rearming of Hezbollah? Is that the bringing of Hezbollah in further into the LAF?
So the answer is that nothing will happen because nothing has happened for 18 years. Look, I take Aoun at face value when he says he wants when he says, he wants to monopolize weapons in the hands of the state, I think he means the Lebanese armed forces and Lebanon security agencies to the exclusion of any private militias. The problem is it's just words. And words and aspirations have to hit up against the hard reality of Lebanese realities and Lebanese politics. And again, the hard reality is what we just described, what I just described earlier. I think it's a massive mistake. I think that it was 94 million that were taken away from the Egyptian budget and redirected to the LAF. Look, we have a lot of qualms, maybe issues with how Egypt runs its affairs, but this is a stable and credible U.S. ally. This has been a pillar of U.S. Power projection in the region since Anwar Sadat took the very wise and very brave decision to say, I'm taking my country out of this orbit, the Soviet orbit, out of war with Israel, and bringing it into the American orbit. They've done things, right? The Egyptians have can do things, right? There is such a thing called Egypt that is able to act. We may have issues with Egypt's human rights records. We may have issues with how they've run the Philadelphia corridor, right? Hamas didn't get airdropped all these weapons, and the material to form these weapons and the materials for the tunnels and all that. All that put aside, you have a credible actor called Egypt. You have an actual thing called the Egyptian army that doesn't require all this political jockeying to take any action, right? And this is why I say nothing will happen, because the LAF, like the rest of Lebanon, as an institution of Lebanon, can only act when there is Lebanese consensus. So in 2017, right? And yes, this is why these American officers speak very highly of the LAF, because when they want to act, we see that they're very credible and very capable, right? But when do they act? They act only against Sunni jihadists because the Lebanese national consensus, that's the only, you can get all Lebanese to agree that we need to take care of the Sunni jihadists. Now, when it comes to the question of Hezbollah, you can't get all Lebanese to agree on the question of Hezbollah because there are Lebanese who are Hezbollah. There are Lebanese who are pro-Hezbollah. Whereas ISIS, I think there was a statistic that I remember reading in like 2015 or 2016, or maybe even a little bit around that time, around the time of ISIS's height. Lebanon was unique among Arab countries where even among Sunnis, there was near zero support for ISIS, right? So there is no support for ISIS. There is no, you don't have to go to the ISIS faction in Lebanon and be like, hey guys, can we act against ISIS? Or the Nusra Front faction. You do have to go to the Hezbollah faction. So this money, 94 million, look, it's based on this assumption that, first of all, there's a total dichotomy between the Lebanese state and Hezbollah. Again, Lebanon equals Hezbollah equals Lebanon is an oversimplification. But the idea that there's a total dichotomy between these two is also an oversimplification, because what we just talked about, Hezbollah is part of Lebanese society. Hezbollah is Lebanese. Hassan Nasrallah had a Lebanese passport. He wasn't an Iranian citizen, as far as I know. And all of the voters are Lebanese. These are, we might not like it again, but from the perspective of Lebanon, Hezbollah is a legitimate party, which again, that should raise implications for how we deal with Lebanon. And they represent a le legitimate Lebanese constituency. So you're not talking about a foreign actor. And the assumption was always, since 2005 and the Syrian occupation ends in Lebanon, well, okay, if we just empower the Lebanese state, right, because of the dichotomy, Lebanese state versus Hezbollah, if we empower Lebanese state, Hezbollah recedes. If we empower LAF, there's no need for Hezbollah. Except while there isn't total collusion between the LAF and Hezbollah, there has been cooperation, there has been overlap, there has been coordination, and it's mutually acknowledged. These aren't enemy factions, right? When in 2017, when Lebanon was fighting against ISIS in Arsal, it's an area in East Lebanon bordering Syria, the Lebanese army and Hezbollah didn't work entirely in tandem, but there was coordination between them. There was at least deconfliction. When the drone, if we recall, there was a drone, I think, in 2019 that hit Beirut. It was reported to be an Israeli drone. Hezbollah inspected the drone and handed it over to the Lebanese army, right? So there's this constant, like, these aren't adversaries necessarily. So empowering the LAF will do nothing. It will do nothing when it comes to Hezbollah. The LAF may then act against, Sunni jihadists or other issues, but when it comes to Hezbollah's interests, we should expect absolutely nothing. And again, don't look to me for this. We've had 20 years now since 2005. I don't know. I'm a lawyer, not a mathematician, so I think it's 20 years. 20 years, and I would challenge anyone to find me a single instance where the LAF took credible action against Hezbollah that had any significant impact on Hezbollah's operations. You won't find a single instance.
Okay, you said the magic word here, because we were limiting the conversation a little bit to Lebanon, but you said the magic word, and that is Syria. And when you say Syria, you also have to say Iran, and you have to look at what happened in Syria. So without Bashar Assad and without Iran, and Iran apparently is taking some of its military capabilities out of Syria for obvious reasons, and the institution of a Syrian government that I don't know if it's ISIS, we don't know, but it's certainly ISIS adjacent. Is that going to change the capabilities of Hezbollah in terms of receiving equipment? Is there a possibility that Hezbollah will find itself challenged and have to deal with an ISIS adjacent government in Syria? Where are we going here? The whole thing has been shaken.
Well, I think it's still shaking, right? I think we're just a month out, maybe a month and a day out from Bashar al-Assad's deposal. And I remember, I've been in DC now 11 years, and I always remember the first Shabbat that I spent in DC. I was sitting with a gentleman who I won't name, a very lovely young man. And we were talking about the Arab Spring. Now, the Arab Spring happened when I was in law school, and I'm a skeptic. I'm cautiously pessimistic, as I've been described. And I remember we're having this discussion at this rabbi's house, the Shabbat table, and I was talking about how the Arab Spring was a failure. And he worked for this Syrian American, he was Jewish, but he worked for the Syrian American activist group. And well, he said, well, no, look at Libya and Tunisia. Those are examples of the success of the Arab Spring. Now, I don't know if we've all been following the news, but they're not, right? So it's I see, look. I will admit this. I've always had a soft spot for Syria. I think I can see parallels in the Jewish story with the Syrians, and the images that we saw out of Syria were heartrending to any human being. There's a joint interest between the Syrian and the Jewish people in the removal of Bashar al-Assad, the downfall of Iran's hegemony over Syria, but also as a people who's suffered atrocities upon atrocity upon atrocity. Something broke my heart to see what was happening in Syria, these massacres happening in real time, and the deniers capable of convincing the world in real time. And you can look at it on camera, the chemical weapons are dropping, and you have this army of propagandists coming out and saying, no, didn't happen. And a West that was too, I don't know, however you want to put it, unwilling to live up to its promises of the past to do anything about this. Syria broke my heart, but also I'm an analyst. I'm going to look at this rationally. And as much as I'm happy to see Bashar al-Assad go, I worry that the Syrian people have gone from the Assad frying pan until the Al-Qaeda fire, because this is where what he's calling himself now is his birth name, Ahmed al-Shara, but Abu Muhammad al-Julani has been known for most of his career. This is where he came from. And people don't change their stripes that quickly. He's not Menachem Begin. He's not Menachem Begin, who came from a liberal rule of law background and went through a phase, questionable. And then when the state emerged, he took off one hat, the militant hat, and he put on another hat and he said, I'm done. And he acted that way. One of my big heroes. I think you can see his picture right here. I don't see the pair. I see too many differences between him and Julani, and we've only had a month. But let's even assume that Julani is absolutely sincere, which I don't think so. Right? I think he's being tactically pragmatic. But let's assume absolute sincerity. Nothing guarantees that Syria won't fracture the way Libya fractured, and then you'll have a good Syria and a bad Syria, and Iran thrives in chaos, and Iran has an interest. Right? This man, it's also at once very vulnerable because Shara, right, Julani is being viewed as the liberator of Syria by many Syrians. There's a cult of personality that's building up around him, even among people. I know many Syrian Christians who are like, this guy's great, right? So, but that doesn't mean that he actually is. But putting that aside, if all your hopes are being put into this one man, what if Iran figures out a way to get rid of him? You can throw the entire system into chaos because you have disparate factions and disparate groups, and the only thing that's uniting them is hope and confidence or affection for this man. And it does, again, there are many, many scenarios where Syria could go very badly, right? Chaos, somehow Iran reestablishes relations with Syria, and we're already seeing movement towards this, where Hezbollah, I actually wrote a piece in Long War Journal that compared the new Secretary General of Hezbollah's Naim Qassem's speech, I think it was 3 days before Assad's downfall, and then the subsequent speech, where 3 days before Assad's downfall, he was describing the factions that would soon take over Syria as jihadists, Takfiri terrorists, We didn't say jihadists. He views jihadists as a good thing, but Takfiri terrorists, ISIS, agents of the West in Israel who are trying to destroy Syria and destroy the resistance. And then 3 days later, suddenly, oh, the Syrian people have the right to decide their fate as they see fit without foreign interference. What? So we're already seeing this shift of narrative, this abrupt shift of narrative, because they realize they took a beating with Assad's downfall. Doesn't mean they're down for the count. Even let's say Julani Sharaa decides to turn Syria into a pro-Western bastion. He decides to cross the border tomorrow. He's the next Anwar Sadat. He goes to Jerusalem. He shakes hands with Bibi, and he's like, "Okay, we're done. Let's make peace." There's still this thing called the Lebanese coast, right? If we look at, again, Gaza, I think is a perfect example. You have an Israeli blockade. One of the most competent, powerful militaries on earth has imposed a near 20-year blockade on Gaza, and look at the capabilities that Hamas has, right? And Hezbollah is not looking for parity with Israel. They're looking to terrorize, right? They're also looking just right now to stabilize their situation in Lebanon, not to be as powerful as Israel, but to be powerful enough that other Lebanese can't digest them. So you have this coast, the coast of Lebanon. You have the airport, you have the ports, and if Hamas could get all of that through the Egyptian and the Israeli military, you're telling me the Lebanese military and UNIFIL are going to block? So there are many possibilities for Iran to play here. Either chaos in Syria, either they create the chaos in Syria, they try to establish good relations with the new government, or they find a roundabout way to continue supplying Hezbollah. Point is, where there's a will, there's a way, and where there's an opening, even, it's like a mouse. I always liken it to a mouse. If you leave this much of a hole, a mouse will crawl through it. That's how the Iranians and their proxies operate. If you leave them this much space, they will find a way to get through it. And that space, in this case, is the Lebanese government's inaction.
So I'm happy, first of all, to find somebody who's at least as much a skeptic as I am about certain things, including the Arab Spring and including US government policy. Because what you're telling us here is that the US government, which is considering taking al-Julani, because that's how I think of him, off the US terror list. He is on the list. He's on it for a reason. We've done it. They're thinking of taking it off because, well, now he's the head of the government. That may not be the best idea. Also have sent, now this is going to stop. I mean, when we change governments, it's going to stop. Amos Hochstein, who concluded the Lebanese maritime border deal, which, if people don't remember, was two separate deals. He concluded one deal with Lebanon and the state of Lebanon, and one deal with the state of Israel, and they wouldn't sign the same document. Lebanon would not sign a document with Israel that was designed to allow Israel and Lebanon to proceed in natural gas exploration. What it really meant was Hezbollah was right there telling the government what to do. Hochstein is back. Hochstein's looking for a ceasefire agreement. And how do we get Israel out of southern Lebanon? I would suggest, particularly based on what you're telling us, that Israel shouldn't leave southern Lebanon until it is absolutely sure that it has taken out everything it needs to. And the same would be true in Syria. So the Israelis have been uprooting Bashar Assad's old chemical capabilities and his missile capabilities and rockets. We should be supporting that because it seems to me that fewer weapons in the hands of any of these people is a good idea, including the Lebanese armed forces. Fewer weapons makes you less dangerous. That's it. Am I wrong?
I think you're right. Look, I mean, and I would flip the equation when it comes to the maritime border deal. Hezbollah was acting as the stick of the Lebanese government implicitly, right? So this is where we see the collusion between the two, right? Rather than this dichotomy between the Lebanese state, Hezbollah was waiting for the Lebanese state, the Lebanese government, to set the parameters, and then they'd act. I think was it Bruce Hoffman? Pretty sure it was Bruce Hoffman. It was either Bruce Hoffman or Daniel Sobelman wrote a whole thing about the coercive diplomacy that Lebanon used during that time period. I'd highly recommend it. I was a big skeptic of the deal, the maritime border deal,
We
and it
were.
was sold. Yeah, as you should have been. And it was sold by, again, some of the same Lebanese activists who will tell you, talk about Shiite oppositions and all that in Lebanon. Ah, well, Lebanon was finally forced to say the word Israel, and I think Prime Minister Yair Lapid, who, otherwise not many qualms with him as prime minister. I'm a big fan of Naftali Bennett. I'm going to tip my hand here again. Also What this table scraps, right? They mentioned your name. Well, of course you have to mention a name. I mean, this is not even the bare minimum of state relations. And coming to the ceasefire deal, yes, all of these fictions are embodied in the ceasefire deal. A colleague of mine, Ahmad Sharawi, and I co-authored a piece on Haaretz, you're welcome to read it, on why this ceasefire deal will actually guarantee war for future generations of Lebanese and Israelis. Because it relies on Lebanon to restrain Hezbollah, and we have not seen the willingness of Lebanon to restrain Hezbollah, and Amos Hochstein just wants a deal. The kind of the you know it's the same thing that I think is animating perhaps these more positive or these more positive reactions from governments towards Julani. Right. So if you look at, say, Turkey or Lebanon or even the European Union, we don't have so much of this problem here in the United States. But there's a big Syrian refugee problem, right? And
Yes.
and it's creating a burden on these societies in different ways, and they all want them out. So now that Assad's gone, everyone's jumping on this to say, well, look, everything's great in Syria. Not because everything's great in Syria necessarily, because we can't tell. It's only been a month out. This was already being said like days in, but because they want to get rid of the refugee problem, the only way to do that is to say everything's great in Syria. So they're willing to blind themselves to get to an end goal. Now, when it comes to Lebanon, there is an end goal, right? This administration, and I'd say most of the Western world, for a long time, we've just wanted quiet. We're like that old cantankerous man who just doesn't want to hear noise from the neighbors. We're just like, can you just do whatever you want to do, do it quietly, stop bothering us. So if quiet is the absolute end goal, quiet in and of itself, not quiet as a stepping stone to something, just quiet, even if it's a deceptive quiet, then you will create fictions just to achieve that end goal, just to achieve that quiet. And the fiction here is that Lebanon will act against Hezbollah. The fiction here is that the LAF is a credible actor. The fiction here is what Amos Hochstein goes to Lebanon and says, I think it was quoted in Shokel Awsat, says we have total confidence in the LAF, but okay, but based on what? Certainly in regards to this specific goal, right? This ceasefire doesn't talk about disarming nebulous groups. It's about Hezbollah. It's about Hezbollah. We've not seen a single, not in the 19 years prior to the ceasefire being achieved, or in the almost 2 months since since the ceasefire was achieved, not a single action has been taken by the Lebanese government against Hezbollah. So this confidence is not coming from reality. It's coming from just sweeping the problem under the rug, kicking the bucket down the road, and not dealing with the problem as it is, just in the interest of achieving absolute quiet.
So the Israelis have a bit of this too. And much as I don't like to criticize the Israeli government, you mentioned that in all of those years when there was a blockade in the Mediterranean and Egypt was enforcing that blockade as well, an awful lot of stuff was coming into Hamas. Hezbollah was building itself, Assad was building itself. And the Israelis would periodically do something about it. And they called it mowing the grass. They would take out somebody or something and they would eliminate a specific problem in a specific space. But I think if there is a single lesson that comes out of everything you've said, and David, I think there are many lessons, so thank you. But if there's a single lesson, it's that's insufficient. That goes for immediate quiet, but it doesn't give you a secure future. And so the way to get to a secure future, in the case of Hamas, would be what the Israelis said initially, which is remove not only their military power, but their governing capability. The US has been opposed to that. We have been extraordinarily bad at understanding as a government why that's a mistake. Again, maybe things will change. I mean, what have we got? It's 11 days, whatever it is, till we change administrations. But the lesson here is that those things that produce immediate quiet do not help you in the long run. So we're getting to the end of the program. And this leads me to what I do to every guest. I'm going to do it to you. First of all, thank you. There is no way, no way that the people on this call and I would have understood Lebanon like this without you. So thank you. But the people who watch us a lot or a little bit know that I like to go out on a positive note. So I'm going to throw that at you. Is there a positive way to end this conversation in terms of how we feel about Israel, how we feel about the Middle East, and I agree with you about the Syrian people. And by the way, I feel the same way about the Palestinian people. people should not be trampled on and abused by their own government. So I'm with you, sympathy for the people, but some of the people are some of the bad guys too. Give us an optimistic thought on which to go out here, can you?
That's I really can't. Not at least not here. Not at this point. Where I see things going is a Hezbollah resurgence. Look, at the end of the day, I don't know if the idea of what it would take to get rid of Hezbollah. Ideally, the Lebanese would do their duty and do it themselves. Absent that, Israel. But for Israel to do so would entail a massive occupation of Lebanon all the way up to the Bekaa Valley. This would be a bigger invasion than what Israel did in 1982. And if you asked me 2 months ago, November 27th, when the ceasefire went into effect, I would have said, well, there's also a complication here because Syria forms a Hezbollah strategic depth. That's thankfully gone. But still, Lebanon is not the size of Gaza. You're talking about the IDF also. It's been fighting a war for almost a year and a half. It's not what the IDF is built for. We're seeing a lot of cases of PTSD, suicide, right? Just being war weary. The IDF needs some R&R, that's for sure. And undertaking such a fight against Hezbollah would be a massive undertaking. I don't know if the Israelis have it in them right
I have
now. Yeah.
so.
So then I would just caution vigilance, vigilance, being absolutely clear-eyed about what this means. This means that Hezbollah will, in time, in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years, experience a resurgence, unless, again, we can't. Look, I say this now, but then who knows what might happen next week, right? The Iranian regime may fall, and that might complicate matters, right? Who would have predicted that Assad would have fallen on December 7th? But as things stand, I think just being absolutely clear-eyed and not, there's we have we as Jews and Israelis and Zionists, we are a people that has experienced persecution for 2,000 years. If anyone shows us a smile, we give them the shirt off our backs. And as much as we want to be, from the biggest peacenik and the most dovish laborite to the most hawkish Likudnik, that's a common thing, right? We want peace. We want to finally end this saga in which we've lived, where the Jewish people are, Am levadad yishkon, and we're hunted, and we just want to be normal, right? Isn't that the whole goal of Zionism? So we have a tendency to fall for nice words, and there are a lot of people who can detect that in us. There are a lot of salesmen, if you will, who can detect that in us, who will sell us all these nice words. And on paper, great. I wish everything they would say would come true. I don't want Hezbollah to come back. One thing you didn't mention about my biography that I don't have in there, I should probably get in there, a former IDF soldier. I was in Sanhanim in 2006. I was in Lebanon. And one of the things that broke my heart was when I'm reading the news now to see the names of the same villages that I fought in 18 years ago, young men who were probably born the day that I was fighting, probably fighting in those villages, were fighting in those same villages 18 years later. And it breaks my heart to think that maybe my children will be fighting in those villages in 18 years from now. And I don't want that. So I don't want this reality where Hezbollah comes back. But better to be vigilant, better to be ready, because look what Israel can do when it's ready. Look what it did to Hezbollah when it had been preparing for this fight, in contrast to how Hamas was able to catch Israel off guard. So absolute vigilance, not falling for nice words, not falling for fantasies as beautiful or as heartwarming as they may seem.
So you failed. You
Yeah.
didn't give us a positive, but you actually did. We are still here, despite everything you said and despite all of the negativism, which I find absolutely rational. The negativism is where we should be. We are still here. And that's the beginning of a positive thought. And then I'm going to ask you if you will come back as things unfold. And maybe you'll be able to answer the question correctly the next time. Maybe things will evolve in a way that makes us look more positively at the region. But for now, I'm going to take Am Yisrael high, and I'm going to say thank you once again. It was a great lesson, and we appreciate it. Thank you, David.
My pleasure, and I hope to have happier analyses and happier news in the future.
Thank you.